Such a peculiar doctrine is alien to our case law. In Abrams v. United States, 1919, this court affirmed the conviction of a group of Russian rebels, revolutionists, and anarchists on the ground that the leaflets they distributed were thought to incite, provoke, and encourage resistance to the United States. Yet Justice Holmes's dissent, which has emphatically carried the day, never inquired into the reasonableness of the United States' judgment that the leaflets would likely undermine the war effort. The dissent instead ridiculed that judgment. Nobody can suppose that the surreptitious publishing of a silly leaflet by an unknown man without more would present any immediate danger that its opinions would hinder the success of the government arms or have any appreciable tendency to do so. In Thomas v. Collins, 1945, we overturned the conviction of a union organizer who violated a restraining order forbidding him from exhorting workers. In so doing, we held that the distinction between advocacy and incitement could not depend on how one of those workers might have understood the organizer's speech. That would put the speaker in the circumstances wholly at the mercy of the varied understanding of his hearers, and consequently of whatever inference may be drawn as to his intent and meaning. In Cox v. Louisiana, 1965, we vacated a civil rights leader's conviction for disturbing the peace, even though a Baton Rouge sheriff had deemed the leader's appeal to students to sit in at the lunch counters to be inflammatory. We never asked if the sheriff's in-person, on-the-spot judgment was reasonable. Even in Fraser, we made no inquiry into whether the school administrators reasonably thought the student's speech was obscene or profane. We rather satisfied ourselves that the pervasive sexual innuendo in Fraser's speech was plainly offensive to both teachers and students, indeed to any mature person. In cases raising First Amendment issues, we have repeatedly held that an appellate court has an obligation to make an independent examination of the whole record in order to make sure that the judgment does not constitute a forbidden intrusion on the field of free expression. To the extent the court independently finds that bong hits for Jesus objectively amounts to the advocacy of illegal drug use, in other words, that it can most reasonably be interpreted as such, that conclusion practically refutes itself. This is a nonsense message, not advocacy. The court's feeble effort to divine its hidden meaning is strong evidence of that. Frederick's credible and uncontradicted explanation for the message, he just wanted to get on television, is also relevant because a speaker who does not intend to persuade his audience can hardly be said to be advocating anything. But most importantly, it takes real imagination to read a cryptic message, the court's characterization, not mine, with a slanting drug reference as an incitement to drug use. Admittedly, some high school students, including those who use drugs, are dumb. Most students, however, do not shed their brains at the schoolhouse gate, and most students know dumb advocacy when they see it. The notion that the message on this banner would actually persuade either the average student or even the dumbest one to change his or her behavior is most implausible. That the court believes such a silly message can be proscribed as advocacy underscores the novelty of its position and suggests that the principle it articulates has no stopping point. Even if advocacy could somehow be wedged into Frederick's obtuse reference to marijuana, that advocacy was at best subtle and ambiguous. There is abundant precedent, including another opinion of the Chief Justice announces today, for the proposition that when the First Amendment is implicated, the tie goes to the speaker, and that when it comes to defining what speech qualifies as the functional equivalent of express advocacy, we give the benefit of the doubt to speech, not censorship. If this were a close case, the tie would go to Frederick's speech, not to the principal strained reading of his quixotic message. Among other things, the court's ham-handed, categorical approach is death to the constitutional imperative to permit unfettered debate, even among high school students, about the wisdom of the war on drugs or of legalizing marijuana for medicinal use. Students may not be confined to the expression of those sentiments that are officially approved. If Frederick's stupid reference to marijuana can, in the court's view, justify censorship, then high school students everywhere could be forgiven for zipping their mouths about drugs at school, lest some reasonable observer censor and then punish them for promoting drugs. Consider, too, that the school district's rule applies no distinction between alcohol and marijuana, but applies even-handedly to all substances that are illegal to minors. Given the tragic consequences of teenage alcohol consumption, drinking causes far more fatal accidents than the misuse of marijuana, the school district's interest in deterring teenage alcohol use is at least comparable to its interest in preventing marijuana use. Under the court's reasoning, must the First Amendment give way whenever a school seeks to punish a student for any speech mentioning beer, or indeed anything else that might be deemed risky to teenagers? While I find it hard to believe the court would support punishing Frederick for flying a "Wine Sips for Jesus" banner, which could quite reasonably be construed either as a protected religious message or as a pro-alcohol message, the breathtaking sweep of its opinion suggests it would. Part 3. Although this case began with a silly, nonsensical banner, it ends with the court inventing out of whole cloth a special First Amendment rule permitting the censorship of any student speech that mentions drugs, at least so long as someone could perceive that speech to contain a latent pro-drug message. Our First Amendment jurisprudence has identified some categories of expression that are less deserving of protection than others: fighting words, obscenity, and commercial speech, to name a few. Rather than reviewing our opinions discussing such categories, I mention two personal recollections that have no doubt influenced my conclusion that it would be profoundly unwise to create special rules for speech about drug and alcohol use. The Vietnam War is remembered today as an unpopular war. During its early stages, however, the dominant opinion that Justice Harlan mentioned in his Tinker dissent regarded opposition to the war as unpatriotic, if not treason. That dominant opinion strongly supported the prosecution of several of those who demonstrated in Grant Park during the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, and the vilification of vocal opponents of the war like Julian Bond. In 1965, when the Des Moines students wore their armbands, the school district's fear that they might start an argument or cause a disturbance was well-founded. Given that context, there is special force to the court's insistence that our Constitution says we must take that risk, and our history says that this is the sort of hazardous freedom, this kind of openness, that is the basis for our national strength and of the independence and vigor of Americans who grow up and live in this relatively permissive, often disputatious society. As we now know, the then dominant opinion about the Vietnam War was not etched in stone. Reaching back further still, the current dominant opinion supporting the war on drugs in general and our anti-marijuana laws in particular is reminiscent of the opinion that supported the nationwide ban on alcohol consumption when I was a student. While alcoholic beverages are now regarded as ordinary articles of commerce, their use was then condemned with the same moral fervor that now supports the war on drugs. The ensuing change in public opinion occurred much more slowly than the relatively rapid shift in Americans' views on the Vietnam War, and progressed on a state-by-state basis over a period of many years. But just as prohibition in the 1920s and early 1930s was secretly questioned by thousands of otherwise law-abiding patrons of bootleggers and speakeasies, today the actions of literally millions of otherwise law-abiding users of marijuana and of the majority of voters in each of the several states that tolerate medicinal uses of the product lead me to wonder whether the fear of disapproval by those in the majority is silencing opponents of the war on drugs. Surely our national experience with alcohol should make us wary of dampening speech, suggesting, however inarticulately, that it would be better to tax and regulate marijuana than to persevere in a futile effort to ban its use entirely. Even in high school, a rule that permits only one point of view to be expressed is less likely to produce correct answers than the open discussion of countervailing views. In the national debate about a serious issue, it is the expression of the minority's viewpoint that most demands the protection of the First Amendment. Whatever the better policy may be, a full and frank discussion of the costs and benefits of the attempt to prohibit the use of marijuana is far wiser than suppression of speech because it is unpopular. I respectfully dissent.